Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to Third Stream View for Monday evening, August 1st, 2011. I'm your humble host, PK, welcoming you all back. We won't be taking any calls today because it's pre-recorded. Obviously, a lot going on in the world, still the aftermath of this tragedy in Norway, which I immediately had questions of, is that a false flag? But before I continue, let me once again thank bbsradio.com for promoting free speech. And thank goodness for the internet and alternative media, because you ain't going to hear it from the corporate Zionist media. And so alternative media gives us this great option and venue of being able to speak our minds and with a very interesting takes on the issues, including controversial hosts, I mean, and interviewers and guests. Today, I welcome back my friend Stephen Lenman, who's quite the author, essayist, peace activist, a Jewish man who is also an anti-Zionist, who's not afraid to stand up to Israel's apartheid injustices, and he speaks his mind as his conscience tells him to honestly go. And I really admire him for that. And I've spoken to him before, and we're on the same page about so many things. So I'm glad to have him coming back to join me this evening, because we're really going to talk about a lot of issues, especially Norway. I've seen Stephen recently on TV about this, and I've read his essays. I always look forward to reading his essays. And his writing style is very pure and clean, and he tells it like it is, and he does his homework. So I consider him a friend, and I am a fan of his. So he'll be coming on here very shortly. Stephen, are you out there?
PK, I sure am.
It sounds like you. Welcome back to Third Stream View, my friend.
Well, I'm happy to be with you. I wish we could sometime do a program when there was something really wonderful to talk about. But if that were the way the world was, PK, I don't think I'd have anything to write about.
That's true. Now, we won't be discussing this today, but we could discuss one of my favorite topics, which is especially American music. And no matter what side of this political spectrum you're on, I can pretty much tell you that I would bet your life on the fact that people love American music in this country. It's greatness, and there's no disputing that, pretty much. When you're talking about jazz, gospel, funk, blues, soul, rock and roll, how can you disagree on the greatness of that?
Well, I grew up at a different time. I'm in my eighth decade, and I remember the 1940s and 1950s when I used to love what was popular music at that time. Back around, there were people around still like Benny Goodman, and swing was still popular. And I've got to rack my mind. Doris Day and
Harry James, baby.
Oh, Harry James, absolutely.
And my favorite, Stephen, the hardest.
I had a cousin. I don't think he's still with us. He was an older generation than myself, and I'm almost 77. He played for Tommy Dorsey.
Great. Well, I treasure the fact that I was 15 when I first saw what I consider to be America's greatest big band, greatest swinging big band. I saw the Count Basie Orchestra with Count Basie four times, and it was amazing. And I love that music. It's just, you know, what a band. Of course, I like Duke Ellington, love Duke Ellington and all those guys. But for me, the Basie band was it.
Well, these are great old names, and I don't keep up now. I have no idea who's popular today.
Well, you still have a good taste in music, I'm sure. Before we continue, would you like some tea or coffee?
Oh, indeed. No sugar.
Well, it's self-service. But so now we get to move on to the living tragedy of our world, so to speak. But I wanted to, before I forget, I wanted to mention that this whole thing reminds me of 1984, where the central national government is continually prosecuting a war overseas while demanding obedience and conformity at home, as in Patriot Act, NSA spying. Do you like that take on things?
Yeah, it really is. We're really living through a 1984 age. We've got Big Brother. We know what Big Brother is. And there's always a bad guy out there, an Emmanuel Goldstein. It's the collective quote unquote terrorist. Now that we don't have Osama to kick around anymore, in fact, we haven't since the end of 2001.
But Cold War.
we managed to keep him alive by producing fake videos and audios. Some of them were very, very bad. They couldn't even get a good video maker, an audio maker, to portray him at least reasonably well. Some of them, experts easily exposed some of the videotapes especially as fraudulent, spliced together. Some of them didn't even look like Osama. But anyway, I mean, he's gone. So the great Satan, the great enemy, is gone. So I'm wondering who they're going to come up with to take his place.
You know, I forgot to ask you this last time. This is an important question, and I've had different answers from different friends. No one really seems to know for sure, but I'd sure like to get your take on this, Stephen. Is ever since its existence, Stephen, where does the CIA get its marching orders from? Not the president, am I right?
Well, the CIA came into existence in 1947. And, you know, before the CIA, we had the OSS.
Correct.
That was the intelligence operation during World War II, and it disbanded. The war ended. We had peace. We actually had a few years when things were relatively peaceful, not entirely, because this country has been at war continuously throughout its history, not a single peaceful years. But maybe the most peaceful in the last century was that interregnum from summer 1945 until June 1950, when Harry Truman got himself the Korean War that he wanted, just like Roosevelt got himself into World War II that he wanted. And America never had to get involved in any of those. And all those wars never had to be fought. But, you know, I mean, the imperial powers and the war profiteers wanted to make money. So they managed to engineer wars because they're very profitable for them. But CIA, I don't know how it began. I guess any new organization begins in one way, and then it changes over the years. But the CIA today, PK, is a power unto itself, just like the Pentagon is a power unto itself. There's no way a president or a Congress can control either one of them. And I remember quoting a line from Jack Kennedy. There were lots of reasons why the power structure wanted to get rid of him. And
of course,
one of them was because he hated the CIA. And one of his quotes was something to the effect that if he had his way, he'd like to rip the CIA into pieces. And that was in the early 1960s. And the implication of that statement was, even then, the CIA was too powerful to challenge. Just imagine how powerful it is today. And nobody knows what its budget is except their own people. But I once heard a figure some years back of $50 billion. That's before George Bush started ramping it up more. I'll bet it's way in excess of $100 billion a year. And it's only one of 16 U.S. intelligence agencies. I think even bigger than CIA is the NSA, because they have the super technology. And, I mean, they can literally spy on anybody everywhere. And how well they do it, they can collect all kinds of data, PK. What on earth they do with it, I have no idea. I mean, just imagine spying on everybody, knowing everything everybody is doing at any point in time, anybody they want to know about. So you're talking about many millions of people. Who goes through this stuff to figure out, is there anything we need to worry about? But in terms of the power and the budget, I guess you don't want to mess with CIA because they are one ruthless, dangerous operation. But they're really two CIAs, Kevin. You've got the analytical side that really tries to do legitimate work, what people like Ray McGovern did when he was there.
Right.
And then you've got the agent in the field side, where they are the mischief side of CIA, and they're the ones committing assassinations, arranging coups, doing dronings. They've got their drone fleet now. So they're doing dronings in Pakistan and Afghanistan. They're flying their drones over the U.S. I mean, they can do anything, and they'll get more money to do more of this stuff. It's a very ruthless, powerful group, and if they want to come get you, they're going to get you.
Well, I'd like to say hello to them now because they're probably listening.
But oh, absolutely. They listen to all my programs.
Oh, I'm sure.
And they read all my articles.
I hope they're a fan of yours. I am. But I still...
I wish I had as many loyal readers as CIA. And I don't want to forget my friends at the FBI. They follow everything I do also.
Of course. But I still... I'm still confused as to sort of where does the CIA get its marching orders when it does these assassinations, when it does all this sort of stuff. I mean, is there one, certainly not the director is not calling the shots. And I know the president wants plausible deniability, I would think. So sort of, I'm wondering who's doing this?
Well, I certainly can't give you a name because I don't know one, but I would guess there are a group of very powerful people in the country, and they're the ones that make policy that the president goes along with and the Congress and probably CIA, at least when it comes to their nefarious activities, some of their intelligence. So these are the people, I would guess, who were involved. Big money people, extremely wealthy, powerful people, like the Nelson Rockefellers of the world, the guy who really is the most powerful of the Bilderberg group. But he's an old man now. He's in his
David
90s.
Rockefeller.
Nelson, yeah. But
sorry,
I would guess it's people...
David Rockefeller.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I didn't mean Nelson. I meant David Rockefeller. Exactly.
I forgive you.
Nelson is long gone. And, of course,
Thank
there's
goodness.
A Rockefeller in the Senate. What's his first name?
Jay
Rockefeller, exactly.
Anybody by the name
of Rockefeller, be suspicious at the least. And don't trust them as far as you can throw them. But David is... David may be the most powerful guy in the world. It's hard to know, but he may be of all. If you could single out one person, it would probably be David. And I remember a nickname he once got. He was called, he still is, the Master Spider. The Master Spider, the guy who, I mean, he really is the leader of the clan of the nation's power structure, which is virtually the world's power structure. So I would guess a lot of what he wants that is in the bailiwick of CIA would be doing it for him and others like him. But who actually gives the marching orders, or maybe a group of people, I can't name names.
Yeah. I get it. Well, I would think that David Rockefeller is second in command to the all-encompassing Rothschild empire.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is.
They're in league with each other.
Oh, yeah. And, of course, he's the guy that's... he was once the head of what's now J.P. Morgan Chase, maybe the most powerful bank in the world, certainly is the most powerful one in America. And Goldman Sachs, of course, very powerful as well. Goldman Sachs is a smaller company than J.P. Morgan Chase. But, again, I mean, you've got that name that goes back many, many years.
Sure.
And that is the Rockefeller Bank. That's what it is. And it's been that way, I think, since the very beginning. A lot of mergers along the way. But besides oil, you've got the banks. And the banks are the most important thing. Whoever controls the money controls the power. They control everything. So, I mean, even CIA, they don't have a printing press, although I guess they could forge everything they wanted. And they've got a major drug operation going.
There you go.
Illicit drug operation going. So they bring in revenue from all kinds of operations. But the banks are involved in that because they launder the money.
You know, and plus the Rockefellers have profited handsomely from wars and militarism.
Oh, absolutely. It's all tied together. Where there are wars, there are bankers. Where there is any kind of industry, there are bankers. Bankers have their dirty paws literally in every business-type operation. So they absolutely sit at the pinnacle of power. And they have the single most important, most powerful instrument to run government, run the world, the power, metaphorically, of the printing press. They have the power to create money. They control money, and they can create as much as they want to have unlimited amounts of credit. If they want to loan it out, I mean, there are unlimited amounts now, but they're not loaning it out. But they can make it looser, make money looser, make money tighter, and in other words, turn the economy on, turn the economy off, or even turn on the printing press and turn the economy off. And I think that's exactly what they've done this time, and I think that's a one-off. I don't think that was ever done before. Usually, when they start creating money, it's to generate economic growth, but that hasn't happened. We've had this fictional economic growth that's benefited the top small percent of people in the country. Given the benefit of the doubt, say the top 10%, but the bottom 90% have suffered bitterly since the end of 2007, and it's not getting better, it's getting worse, and bankers have it in their power to change that, but they don't do it. That's a separate topic. In a word, you know, I mean, the real question is, well, why not? Doesn't that lift all boats? Won't they be more profitable if they would do that? Yeah, well, they would be profitable, but they could be more profitable by doing what they're doing now. Create an economic debacle on a global scale. Turn nations into what Greece is right now. So Greece is being strip-mined. The idea in Greece is impoverish it, make it debt-entrapped to bankers, make them sell off their state assets, their enterprises. Heaven help them. The Parthenon, whatever these predators want, let them come in and strip-mine the country at fire sale prices, you know, once-in-a-lifetime sale prices. That's what this is all about. It's also about the bankers getting more powerful. They've consolidated more in this. A lot of their competitors have gone under. So Goldman is bigger. J.P. Morgan Chase is bigger. The survivors, the big survivors, are better. And we just found out, PK, that, and I think the number is greater than this, but we just found out from a government audit that the Federal Reserve, which, of course, is owned and operated by the big banks, mainly the big New York Wall Street ones, they gave these banks $16.1 trillion, T with a Tom. But I think the number is even greater than that because they've been stealing it left and right. Supposedly, these were emergency loans to be paid back. I have no idea if they were paid back or not.
Well, you're referring mainly when you talk to bankers, I take it to mean the central banks, the Fed. Now, all the other banks are tied in. As I mentioned when we last spoke, people tend to blame the banks. But, yes, the bankers are culpable, but they're all tied into the Fed, the main spider, if you will. And they're creating trillions out of thin air, which is destroying the value of the dollar even further. And no time in history has the Fed ever had its back against the wall as it has since Ron Paul has actively been wanting it to be audited. He wants Fort Knox audited. If anybody has a right to know what's in Fort Knox, we citizens do. But you have this whole federal government, which is the enemy, opposed to all this, just protecting its own. And if you're on a government payroll, well, then you're part of this apparatus, you know, and you got to protect your own interests. So that's what I see going on.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The power structure that runs the country, the names and faces people know, PK, the Obamas and the Boehners and the Pelosis and the Reeds, they're just cogs in the wheel. They come and they go. But the power structure is always there. The people who run it, you know, they get old and they pass, and others take their place. But it's that permanent power structure that runs the country, and their agenda is seriously nefarious. They literally want everything for themselves, total power, total wealth. That's been the agenda since Reagan came to office in the 1980s. The mass theft from the U.S. public accelerated under George Bush. It's accelerated much faster under Obama. Anybody who thinks Obama is a Democrat on the populist side of the fence, a leftist Senate Democrat, absolutely is living in a dream world. I've written volumes about him, PK, but I had a reasonable idea what we were getting when he took office, because I wrote about him in the U.S. during the campaign in 2008. I wrote about his voting record in the Senate, and if you took out the name Obama and just looked at what he voted for, he was as Republican as any hardline Republican. He was pro-business all the way down the line. I can't recall what he had to say. I think he supported Afghanistan.
Yes.
I can't remember what he did on Iraq. I know his rhetoric belied his policies. I've got a wonderful quote that he made in the fall of 2007, I believe, when he just became a candidate, or the early stage of his candidacy. It was a wonderful quote. It was a little lengthy, but it was something to the effect that if I become president, I assure you, if the Afghanistan war isn't over, I assure you that I will pull the troops out. And I remember his punchline. It was, and you can take that to the bank.
I remember that. But based on everything you've just said about Obama, all your objective criticisms of Obama, I think that you're a racist.
Oh, I'm not a racist at all.
I'm trying to be funny here, because
that is
what a lot of his supporters in the media try to shape. All criticism, any criticism of Obama, it's racism, as a way to try to shut down dissent and censor people like us who speak objectively and quote him from the past. Gee, I'm a racist because I'm quoting him exactly.
Well, there are people...
You've noticed this, right? You've noticed this.
I have never gotten a response from a reader who called me a racist, but I have gotten some responses calling me a self-hating Jew.
Because of course.
I'm extremely critical of Israel, but I rely to the as best I can, PK, in everything I do. I go for the facts and I present them honestly, and I am merciless in explaining facts as I discover them, and I learn things every time I write an article, and I want to share them with other people, and I refuse to back off from anything that's important, controversial. If there's factual stuff to back it up, I think it's important. I think people need to know about it. And the most controversial stuff are the things that I want to address most, provided I can get solid information to make a case. So I know what Obama is doing. I know what he supports. I know what his agenda is. I want to talk about it. And at the same time, I'm colorblind. And I'm Jewish. But I am merciless on Israel because I know what Israel is doing. I know what its agenda is. I know the crimes it's committed. And I absolutely will not back off discussing them. And I certainly have an awful lot of company. There's a website, forget the name of it exactly, but it lists a lot of Jewish people, and I'm honored to be among them. And they gave me a bigger write-up than some other people who should have gotten more attention than me, better-known people than me. And they had my photo there, but a write-up about me, I mean, just lighting into me about how hostile I was to Israel. Well, I'm not hostile to Jews. I'm not hostile to any nation.
I am
hostile to criminal policies. That's what I'm hostile to. I am against nations that go around the world committing grievous human rights abuses, crimes of war, and against humanity. Everybody should be against those things. Of course, as bad as Israel is, PK, they're pikers compared to America.
Yes. You know, again, I was just kidding you about you being a racist, because I don't know if you've noticed this, but there is a lot of this mentality. Sheila Jackson Lee, representative from Texas, said it a week or two ago that she's accusing people of a racism because they were criticizing Obama. You know, when you criticize his policies, like you said, you're colorblind. So I was kidding you about that.
And I know you were kidding.
And I applaud the fact that you, being Jewish, are anti-Zionist and are very critical of Israel, and you've got the cojones to speak up about it. And I myself, I'm not Jewish, but I am very critical of Israel, Zionism, and Jewish power, and I will not shut up about it either. Now, you, my friend, are Jewish, and I'll tell you what, you are welcome in my house anytime. I would buy you a drink, and I would take you to dinner. If that's hate or anti-Semitism, then let it be, because that's where I'm coming from, my friend.
Well, PK, I feel the same way about you and everybody else who stands up for truth and justice and equity and for peace. And I mean, all the principles that that Israel endorses, that this country endorses, but their policies are exactly the opposite. And there are too many people who back off from these things. They won't criticize Israel. There are people in my family who want nothing to do with me because of where I stand. But, you know, they don't take the trouble to examine the facts. I have an old boyhood friend. Oh, he was a very good friend way back, and we lost touch for so many years. And he discovered me through my writing, and then he began spotting the articles I wrote about Israel. And he really a terrific guy, a doctor, a very decent guy, a very intelligent guy. And I have another friend. I would say these two were probably my closest boyhood friends. Another one who also became a doctor probably was my closest boyhood friend. I lost touch with him as well, and I reconnected with him through this second one who gave me his email address, and I sent them. The second one gets all my articles. What he reads and what he doesn't read, I don't know. I know he despises what I say about Israel. Very politely, he said to me things like, basically to the effect, why are you a self-hating Jew? And once in a while, he'll send me an article, a propaganda article that he subscribes to, showing his ignorance, and it's shameful because he should know better, putting out shameful pro-Israeli propaganda, anti-Palestinian propaganda, anti-Hamas propaganda, just shameful stuff. But this other friend, and we only lived a few houses away from each other when we grew up as boys, he read an article that I wrote during the Cash-Led War in early 2009, end of 2007, 2008, I guess. Was it 8 or 9? I'm losing track of time. Anyway, Operation Cash-Led, that 22-23-day massacre and mass destruction in Gaza. And he read one of my articles. I was writing daily articles on it as the war was going on, just keeping up a daily account of what was happening. There was so much to be said. All factual, just honest, important stuff. He read one of my articles and sent me the most hateful email. I could not believe this came from my best boyhood friend, the opposite of the second one, who didn't like what I said, but was very polite, very respectful. But this other fellow was vicious and hateful, but he showed his ignorance. They both showed their ignorance that they literally don't know what's going on. Find out the truth and then form your opinions based on it. And if you still want them to be the same way, fine, but then we have a name for you. Anybody who supports mass murder and mass destruction, there are a lot of names, PK, for people like that, and none of them are good.
Neocon.
Neocon is one. Well, I would consider anybody like that a criminal. I mean, if you support those kinds of policies, that at least symbolically makes you complicit in them. Because it's because of people like you that lets governments get away with this stuff. If everybody felt like you and me, PK, they never would get away with it because we wouldn't let them.
That's right, and I bet that you would even find even more agreement with me about economics, because we ended up agreeing on a lot of things on our last conversation, if you recall, when I did my rant about the perversion of capitalism, what's happened to a real free market. And you agreed with me about your opposition to bailouts, crony capitalism, corporate welfare, political privilege, and protectionism.
Oh, very definitely. We have a system that really is, we don't have a capitalist system. And I'll remind, I may have mentioned it last time, but I'll mention it this time in case I didn't. I am a graduate of the Wharton School. I got my MBA at the beginning of 1960. And I'll mention one thing I don't think I mentioned last time I came on. The Wharton, we, 50th reunion year was a year ago this past June. So I'm past the 51st now. But I was nearly invited back to address my fellow alums, and instead they chose a corporate CEO whose speech I read, and he had marvelous stuff in it that I absolutely agree with. He also was upset about a lot of the stuff going on. I got his email address through Wharton. We exchanged a couple of emails, and his words to me were, I told him what I'm doing now. His words to me were to the effect, keep at it. Keep up the fight. In other words, he did not like what America is doing right now, what America became, the wars and the destruction and the extreme privilege. This is coming from an ex-CEO of a major corporation, and he was telling me to keep at this and keep doing it. But Wharton gave me a consolation prize. They featured me in one of their newsletters. They wrote me up a marvelous write-up with direct quotes from me on what I believe in and what I'm doing, what I stand for. No punches pulled, PK. I couldn't believe that this appeared in a Wharton publication, but they did it, and I was scratching my head wondering,
wow,
are people at the Wharton School starting to worry about the stuff that they're teaching kids to go out in the world and plunder? I mean, maybe that's not such a good idea after all. Well, nobody taught me to go out in the world and plunder, but, you know, I got a basic business education. But I am a product of the Wharton School and a scathing critic of what absolutely is not capitalism. It's not the capitalism I would ever give a definition for. It's state socialism and free market for the big deals, for the rich and powerful. And it's free market capitalism. On your own, sink or swim for the rest of us. That's not capitalism.
I thought of a crude analogy for capitalism. Let's say, I don't know if you do own a car or not, but let's say that you own a car. Now, the car serves your purpose to maybe help your friends, go shopping, et cetera, et cetera. But if you use that car to rob banks or run down innocent people, you've perverted the use of that car.
Oh, absolutely. I used to own a car. I don't anymore. But that's a great analogy.
Let me back up a little bit, Stephen. You mentioned a lot of this stuff happened in the Reagan years. Recently, I've been reading Hamilton's Curse by the great Austrian school economist, historian, Thomas DiLorenzo. And, Stephen, every page I read makes me angrier than the previous one. If we really knew that we have a legacy of Alexander Hamilton, who was for all of these things that we've spoken about that we oppose, more empire, glorification of state power, crony capitalism, a central bank, all these things. Jefferson won the election, but unfortunately, we have the legacy of Hamiltonianism. So if you get a chance to pick up that book, it's not real thick. It's called Hamilton's Curse. You will see the legacy of what happened and his perversion of the Constitution with his lawyerly maneuvering. He was the one that got George Washington to caused the whiskey rebellion against the farmers in western Pennsylvania to collect more taxes. He wanted a big government. He wanted big debt. And that way the rich would be more interested in paying more taxes and having big government. So it really goes further back. And again, every page I read makes me angrier than the one before. But even more importantly, Stephen, and thank goodness for the internet and alternative media, is that thank goodness for objective, intellectual, scholarly revisionism. And it turns out that a lot of it, things you write, things I say, is hated by the masses because they sort of hate the truth. Maybe they think, you know, we are correct, but we just don't want to believe it. We don't want to believe it. We don't want to deal with it. But you and I are not going to stop our journey for truth.
Oh, absolutely. I've never written an article entirely on Alexander Hamilton, but I know he may have been the first neocon.
I
have
definitely
written a paragraph or two paragraphs about him. And I know, I mean, he was the Robert Rubin or the Timothy Geithner of his day. And the first Secretary of the Treasury. And he was not the kind of guy you wanted in charge of the nation's money.
True. In retrospect, Stephen, in retrospect, it's a shame that Aaron Burr didn't whack him 20 years earlier.
Oh, it's a real shame. It's a real shame that duel didn't come out the other way.
Stephen, let's move on to the tragedy.
Can I mention one thing?
Sure.
While we were chatting just in the last minute or so, I was trying to find a quote from Andrew Jackson. Andrew Jackson may have been the only U.S. president who ever took shots at the bankers. I mean, he called them hydra-headed, or the Bank of the United States. He would not renew the charter. That was the equivalent of the Federal Reserve today. Bank of the United States. He would not renew the charter, but he really took aim at the bankers, and he said some very, very pointed things about them. Recently, I saw a quote. I'd have to take a little bit of time.
I know what you mean.
To see if I can find it again.
You are correct, Stephen, but actually, he was the second president to deal with the second bank of the U.S. Jefferson helped lead to the demise of the first one. Now we have the Jefferson of our day, Ron Paul, who would like to see the Federal Reserve done away with, audited, and phased out. So, yes, it's happened twice before, and now it's got its back against the wall again. And Jackson, when he railed against the second bank of the U.S., well, of course, there was European interests involved. The Rothschilds were trying to weasel their way into the American banking system. So it goes way back. You're correct.
It really does go way back. And even Abraham Lincoln was very upset at the bankers. And there are some great quotes from him. And he took control of the nation's money during the Civil War because the bankers wanted to charge too much interest. He wouldn't pay them. So he got the Congress to print greenbacks, where the term greenback comes from, and the government got its money interest-free instead of paying somewhere between 18 and 36% interest that the bankers wanted because, I guess, they just wanted to scam the country. That's what they wanted to do. But, you know, their rationale was that, you've got two sides fighting each other. It's a high-risk loan to either side, so we want to be paid for the loan. Well, I mean, the Union was going to win. They were stronger than the South. That was the industrial North against the agrarian South. So, it really wasn't that a risky loan. But Lincoln was very upset with the bankers, but we certainly don't find Roosevelt rhetorically was upset with the bankers and Franklin Roosevelt, and did some things that were good, but he also bailed them out, not the way Obama has bailed them out, and Obama is no Franklin Roosevelt, that is for sure. But this is very ugly stuff. If we could ever get that problem under control, BK, all the other pieces would fall into place. That really is the number one thing to take issue with. But ahead of that, it's getting the public educated, getting people to understand not just what's going on. That's not enough. People need to understand that the destructive policies are harming them directly, their families, their children, their grandchildren if they have them. If they're satisfied to let that happen, then just sit back, complain, watch a ball game, do nothing, things will get worse, and what few benefits remain in this country will all disappear. Our rights are disappearing, our benefits are disappearing, and the scheme, the bipartisan scheme, and Obama is the man leading it right now as long as he's in the White House, the bipartisan scheme is literally to take away to destroy America's social contract, everything, do it by stealth, do it incrementally, claim it's being done to sustain it, one of the many big lies. They want to end Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, publicly funded pensions, and everything else. But they'll be very careful, very clever the way they're doing it, and again, you know, they play the game, we have to fix it because it is unsustainable. the way it is now, that's a big lie. They're very sustainable. What's unsustainable is our present financial system, letting bankers run the country, spending well over $1 trillion, I think on the order of $1.5 trillion a year, on militarism and military-related activities, including
homeland
security, including intelligence, everything related to militarism, in round numbers, $1.5 trillion a year. But the budget debate now is excluding making cuts to the Pentagon, to militarism, except maybe token stuff that doesn't amount to anything.
True.
And the so-called Simpson-Bowles package, this was Obama's deficit-cutting commission, they proposed cutting $100 billion from defense spending. Well, I call it a stealth cut because they want to do things like raise premiums for health insurance on veterans, maybe give active duty people less health care. In other words, they're not going to deprive the Pentagon of anything the Pentagon wants. They will make fringe cuts that don't amount to very much, and maybe people in uniform or veterans will be harmed, but the people who want to fight wars endlessly, they will get as much as they want, and the budget will go up every year. So it's a scam. But
yes,
nobody talks about that. Nobody talks about taxing the rich. Nobody talks about the things that could easily fix the problems of the country, easily. Instead, they fester. They get worse. The policies are designed to make them worse. The people in this country are suffering. Things will get worse. Michael Hudson, economist Michael Hudson, says Greece, and I think your listeners know what's going on in Greece, Greece is a dress rehearsal for America.
Well,
I think
Greece,
so.
You know, Greece has also very badly mismanaged their economy, and practically half the people work for the state. It doesn't really have much to export. It's paid huge salaries to people in jobs that should never make that kind of money. I mean, you're right, but it is a combination of things. Back to this military-industrial complex, Stephen, and this whole mess we're in, and the people that are suffering. Here's the irony, Stephen, that a lot of these people that are suffering, they've either been in the military or have friends or children in the military, and they're still rather real supportive of this massive military-industrial complex, and America's got to be the leader in the world. America's got to do this. America's got to do that. They don't understand what we understand about the bankrupting effect of it. So they're sort of opposed sometimes to where we're coming from. They feel like to be opposed to all this war and stuff is to be opposed to the military, and, you know, so they don't get it, a lot of them. I'm sorry to say, a lot of the rank and file, they don't get it.
They really don't get it, and it's because they don't do their due diligence. They don't take a little bit of time to go online, go to good websites, read good articles on important topics. Instead, they turn on their TV set, and whether they watch Fox or CNN or MSNBC, MSNBC may be marginally better than Fox, but there are certain things they don't touch.
Sure.
They don't mess with war and peace. They don't mess with corporate power. Oh, maybe a little bit, but not the way they should. They'll go so far, but no further.
Corporate power.
Oh, yeah. Where they stop is where I most want to go, because the most important stuff. They'll never condemn the imperial wars. Every one of them is illegal. What's going on is shocking, shameful, and it's bankrupting the country. It is harming so many people. So ordinary people in this country, PK, they'll come home and they'll rely on TV, so-called TV news. Well, that's a guarantee to know nothing about what's going on. And TV news has the power of repetition. They keep going over the same ground. It may be new stories, the daily headlines, whatever they are, but the themes keep repeating over and over again. So people actually think It's a good idea to be in Afghanistan, maybe. It's a good idea to be in Libya. It's a good idea to fix Social Security and Medicare, having no idea that the real scheme is to destroy them, having no idea that we didn't go, that Gaddafi is not the issue in Libya. The
True.
Issue is literally exploiting, colonizing a country, literally doing to Libya what we did to Iraq, if these people have any idea what's been done to Iraq. The old Iraq, the cradle of civilization, no longer exists. Afghanistan, as it was really decades ago, no longer exists. That's the plan for Libya, and they may have to do it in more than one stage, the way they ran the Balkan Wars. Those were Clinton's wars in the 1990s, the Balkan awesome. Wars that went on throughout the decade, throughout the whole decade, and it broke up Yugoslavia into half a dozen pieces or so, and this is the idea for Libya. Iraq's been balkanized into three pieces. Afghanistan, I don't know how many pieces it's in. I mean, there's a real war going on there. So the resistance, as I call it, they want their country back. So it could be in pieces, but they want to put it back together again, and they'll probably end up doing it at some point. But that war is raging. And Libya has also already been split into two pieces. Terrible exploitation going on. In just the last couple of days, since the beginning of the bombing began, they are targeting civilian targets, supposedly a no-fly zone, PK, to protect yeah. civilians. They are deliberately hitting civilian targets, civilian homes, hospitals, a food storage warehouse or depot in the last few days. They bombed. Libya has a remarkable project that they began in the 1980s, the Great Man-Made River Project. There is a massive True. Ocean-sized aquifer beneath the sands of Libya, enough water to last conceivably for thousands of years. Gaddafi called it the eighth wonder of the world, and he did not exaggerate. They built a massive pipeline system that is still being built. They have targeted parts of it. They targeted a factory producing pipe for this system. They're cutting off food to Libyan people. They want to starve them. They want to deprive them of fresh water. They want to destroy their neighborhoods. They want to hit all of their civilian infrastructure. You never hear anything about this in the news. And there are reporters from the major Western news services in Libya, from CNN, from New York Times, the Washington Post, maybe Fox, the BBC, and they're there seeing what the independent people are seeing. I've had about 8 reports from Libya, brief ones, including but Cynthia McKinney when he was there. They on the ground, they're in the Tripoli area, they on the ground are seeing one thing, and they know what's going on. These same reporters who were in the area with them, they're seeing the exact same things, and they suppress it. They suppress it. They won't report it. They might as well pack up. Well, they're reporting propaganda instead. So you get that going on, and so much more, PK. And then we had this nasty incident in Oslo. Want to chat about that for a few minutes?
Yes, but Stephen, why should we care? They're Muslims. Kill them all. Little humor
well,
there,
I know,
Stephen.
I know a little bit
humor.
About Islam, Stephen. And I know enough to know that the roots of Islam, Judaism, and Christianity are virtually the same.
Oh, I was just kidding. Stephen,
I know you're kidding. I know you're kidding.
Stephen,
if you line up the core beliefs from the Bible, Old and New Testament, from the Torah, the Talmud, the Jewish religion, the Old Testament, well, the Old Testament, the New Testament, and the Quran, but you took off the names of these things, you would hardly know the difference from one religion to the other. So for one religion to demonize another religion, there's got to be another reason that's saying there's something wrong with this religion. It's not the religion there's something wrong with. There's a political agenda, and that's what's going on. Well, Muslims are beaten up on because they are the convenient scapegoat to
True.
Instill fear in the public to justify the imperial wars and the so-called war on terror. So you need an enemy. In the Cold War PK, we had the evil empire, the Soviet Union, and when they dissolved in 1991, we desperately needed a new enemy, so it became Muslims in general, and it became Saddam. And Saddam came right out of room service. Well, then we got rid of him, so we still needed a war
like
on
that.
Islam. And, I mean, if Islam suddenly disappeared, we'd need to invent a new enemy. I mean, we had Osama for a while, so we could put an actual name on it. But the general enemy is Islam, and it's raging throughout Western society. And this
Stephen,
is part of what went on in Oslo.
You're right. And, Stephen, at this point, I'd like to say something profound. At least the football strike has been settled, so now that's another great diversion of sports for the masses. Sports, professional sports, keep them, sedated with that mentality. That's I see a lot of that too.
Oh, absolutely. I call it bread and circuses.
Of course.
Sports at the top of the list because people go wild over football, basketball, all these things. That is the number one entertainment that most people crave. And after sports, of course, you've got films, you've got the regular television fare, everything from sitcoms to movies, all kinds of stuff.
Can I tell you my favorite part about...
Even so-called news is more info, aside from the propaganda, it's more infotainment than it is real news. It certainly isn't real news. It's a combination of propaganda, managed news, infotainment, junk food news. So people OD on this, and this is the bread and circus that distracts people from the things that are affecting their lives. I tune out to that. I absolutely tune out. If people want legitimate news, I'll tell you where you can get it on television, and anybody with a computer can access it easily. Go to Russia Today, RT.com, 24 hours a day, and Press TV. My goodness, Press TV from Iran, from Tehran? Well, let me tell you, Press TV is legitimate news. They have me on often, but I'm not the only one. They have a marvelous array of people they bring on to discuss vital issues, and there are people that I am delighted to have on my program because they speak honestly, forthrightly, and this is coming from Tehran. So Press TV has a marvelous service. There's nothing in America that matches it in corporate news, radio, TV, publications. I think the main Iranian newspaper, I forget the precise name of it, but I think the equivalent of the New York Times in Tehran has actually published a few of my articles, PK, if you can believe that.
Well, that's great. And I want you to know that I'm an American who actually knows that the former name of Iran is Persia, and the language they speak is Farsi. And how about this, Stephen? There's actually, probably mostly in Tehran, the area, there's about a little over probably 25,000 Jews who live in Iran who are not threatened and who like to live there and who've been there for centuries.
Oh, they have been there for centuries. And Iran is not an Arab country, even though it has an Arab population. But Iran is a Persian country. Well, that's the
Shiite wing of Islam.
Oh, they're very much Islamic, and they're predominantly...
And most of the rest are Sunni.
Yeah, they're predominantly Shiites. They have a Sunni population, too. There's generally a mix of the two in all of the Arabic countries, but I think Sunni is more dominant than Shiite, and Shiites seem to be, in the eyes of the West, the Sunnis are the good guys and the Shiites are the bad guys.
I mean,
they all believe in the Quran. They're all Muslims. There are different strains. Just like in Judaism, you've got Orthodox, Conservative, and Reformed, and you've got all kinds of strains of Protestantism. And
sure.
I guess Catholicism may be the most straight-laced, but you've got Greek Orthodox and you've got Roman Catholic. So, I mean, there are strains of all the religions, But I think the court to demonize them is absolutely ludicrous. But again, if you get propagandized and your mind is manipulated enough, you can be taught to love or hate anything without the rationale, without reasoning something out on your own. You literally let somebody else put the ideas into your head and you go with them. Maybe this is part of what this fellow Anders Breivik was all about. But I think it's a mistake to focus on him.
What is your take on Norway, Stephen?
In Norway, absolutely. Anders Breivik, this neocon Christian fundamentalist, he said that he did what he did. So I guess I have to believe that he did it. But there is evidence that he wasn't alone. That I wrote three articles on this. In one article, I quoted from a Norwegian newspaper that two eyewitnesses, I believe it was two, said there was shooting coming from two distinct parts of the island simultaneously. Probably so. That would mean there was at least one more shooter. How this man alone could have killed that many people without these people, without enough of them having enough time to get away, I have no idea. Now they were on an island, so they'd have to swim away. But scatter, do anything, get in the water, swim like crazy. Just get away from this stuff. He can't be watching everybody at the same time. They said something else about him that bothered me, that he went about his killing. Like an automaton, maybe that's the word I want. I mean, emotionless. He simply went about it like he was sweeping a floor, a mopping up. No emotion, just shooting people and killing one after another, almost like he was programmed to do it. So the first thought in my mind was, gee, this description almost makes me think he was a Manchurian tool. That somehow this guy was programmed, but what's bothered me has been not just the number of people that he supposedly killed by himself, but that he pulled off what may have been a sophisticated bombing. There may have been more than one car bomb. I mainly listened to an interview on Press TV given by a consultant. His last name was E-Y-R-E. Forget his first name, but I listened to it in the news, and he had one line in the interview where he spoke about bombs inside the buildings in downtown Oslo. He didn't elaborate, and I don't know if he was speculating or whether he knew something, but that was a thought that I had, because that's exactly what happened in Oklahoma City in 1995. It wasn't the car bomb that did the massive damage. It was multiple explosives rigged inside the building. And who discovered it? A former Air Force general in charge of an armaments and weapons research lab at Elgin Air Force Base in Florida. And he did a study and published it 2.5 months after the incident. And he concluded, absolutely. He said, there is a massive cover-up about this event. And he said what did the damage that covered a 16-square-mile area, much bigger than Oslo, was multiple explosives inside the building. The first thought I had was, were there explosives inside any one of these buildings in Oslo? I don't know. I didn't say it in an article. I just know there was one car bomb. It was big enough to do a fair amount of damage. Only killed about 8 people. Could be others who will die because there were injuries as well. So it did a fair amount of damage, not on the Oklahoma City scale. But did he do this himself? Or did somebody else do it? Or did somebody else help him do it? And I just can't help imagining there's more to this than a lone bomber gunman. I can't prove it. I didn't use this line, but I wish I did. These people don't leave fingerprints around for easy ID.
Well, they're the masters of deception.
Oh, yeah. Whether we're talking about CIA, Mossad, MI6 in Britain.
Right.
Very hard to detect these people. They're masters at what they do, and they're masters at using people. And there are so many past false flags. I've written about numerous ones. The most obvious is 9/11. Oklahoma City, another one. There were big ones in Europe. The Madrid bombing, 2004. The London Underground bombing, the so-called 7/7 bombing, the year after that. These were false flags. These were state operations blamed on Islamic terrorists. Of course, the Oslo thing, the media jumped right on that and blamed it against Islamic terrorists.
Of course. Well,
and then they had to switch signals.
I certainly like your take on it. And my first impression was, it's another false flag. And then I thought, okay, well, he might have shot those people, but I don't think he blew up that building. And then I also thought, of course, well, is this guy the Patsy? Is he the Oswald? Is he the Sirhan Sirhan? Has he been enabled? Is that fairly a good, reasoning about this?
I would say this. I know for certain that Sirhan Sirhan had nothing whatsoever to do with killing Bobby Kennedy. I wrote about Sirhan Sirhan. I used material that a guy who was working inside the prison sent to me. He interviewed him at length, and he sent me the material. He recorded it, so then he transcribed the recording, and he sent it to me verbatim, and I wrote an article about Sirhan Sirhan. I am absolutely 100% sure he had nothing to do with killing Bobby Kennedy. It was a guard at the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles who pulled the trigger. He was the guy. He was the CIA hitman. And I have no idea whether Oswald was in any way involved with killing Kennedy, but I think there were multiple people involved. It was a CIA hit again. And James Earl Ray, Martin Luther King, he had nothing to do with it. The rifle he owned, ballistics proved it didn't fire the shots. He never even got a trial. Well, of course, Oswald was assassinated. Sirhan is sitting in prison unjustly. If they want to get rid of the evidence, they get rid of it. They do what they want with the fall guys, and they put them away, and the real crime goes undetected. You have lots of theories and lots of conspiracies. When people call me a conspiracist, I like to reply, only the ones that are true are the ones that I subscribe to. The others I want nothing to do with. But if there seemed to be any kind of justifiable evidence attached to something where the official report goes the other way, then I absolutely want to latch onto it and see what else I can find and at least talk about what we know. So I don't care about Lee Harvey Oswald. I care about the CIA killing Kennedy. That's what it's all about. And if Oswald was the trigger man, that was just like a mafia hitman. It's not the hitman who matters. It's the godfather who paid him and said, go out and do this for me. It's the godfather I care about. Well, the CIA is the godfather here, and MI6 is in Britain, and Mossad, well, CIA and Mossad, and MI6, I guess. I mean, they do this stuff all over the world. Mossad does. Mossad certainly does it in Lebanon. They've done it in other countries. The Harari killing some years ago in Lebanon, recently blamed on Hezbollah. Hezbollah had nothing to do with it. This was a Mossad operation. Classic. Another car bomb, PK. Another car bomb, that a massive one, that blew something like a 16-foot hole in the ground, in the street. They wanted to be sure they got this guy, and they sure did, and others along with him. But that was a classic Mossad operation. Were there fingerprints on it? As a matter of fact, there were, because Hezbollah had audio and video of Israeli surveillance over things like the route that the Prime Minister Harari would take to go to where he was going the day they killed him. They had clear evidence that Israel had mapped out that route and knew exactly what he did and when he did it. And if they wanted to get him, they knew exactly where he would be at what time. So they just set the trap and bingo, pulled it off, and they got him. Well, yeah. I absolutely think Mossad killed him, and there have been lots of other operations. Did Mossad pull off the Oslo thing? I don't know for certain. I think I was a little too strong in the statements that I made, because I said things like their fingerprints are all over this. Well, that really isn't so. Their fingerprints are not all over it. Their modus operandi is all over it.
True.
In that respect, you could call them fingerprints. But did they leave proof behind that they did this? Absolutely not. They never do. They're much too clever for that. I have no doubt that the Mossad poisoned Yasser Arafat. His doctor, Arafat's doctor, believed it, and I believed it, but they never gave anybody a chance to do an autopsy. He died in France, and they never gave anybody a chance to do an autopsy to see if they could figure out what exactly killed him, and they claimed there was some kind of an illness, whatever. But he succumbed much too fast. He needed help much too fast. The whole thing was fishy. And when a guy's own doctor, who took care of him for 25 years, said he was poisoned, certainly wasn't his aides that poisoned him, so I think he was killed. But they're very clever. I guess they can even use an undetectable poison, or
sure,
pretty close to that.
They're the masters of it.
They are the masters. They really are the masters. So, I mean, they really can cover their tracks. So you have to do a little bit of speculating. But when you see the same thing go on repeatedly, the same pattern is repeated, and I'm looking for something that puts strategic timing together with the Oslo incident. Usually there's something strategic tied with an incident. Well, it could be to stoke fear. Maybe they need a little bit more stoking in Europe. Pulling out of the Libya coalition. Norway is just about out of it now. The Netherlands pulled out of it. Italy stopped the flights coming from their air base, their in-country air base. It could be that they want to stoke the fear of terrorism again to keep the coalition intact. It could be part of that. There's other things about Norway. Norway has been very pro-Palestinian, very critical of Israel. They've divested from Israel investments.
True.
They have been as much critical of Israeli policies. To say anti-Israel is the wrong term. Critical of Israeli policies more than any Western country, and as much so as Chavez in Venezuela, Castro in Cuba, and I'm not sure anybody else. Maybe a few others a little bit.
That's
but
true.
No country in Europe. No other country in Europe. So to me, that was a motive for going after them. You do nasty things to us, we'll come back and do them to you.
This shooter was very pro-Israel and very pro-Zionist, I've read extensively.
Yep.
He's
yep.
one of these types. Also, Stephen, I want you to know that I'm really enjoying the conversation today. I wonder if you could stick around so we could just stick around for the end of this next hour. We could make it like sort of part two. Would that work for you?
Look, you have a two-hour show?
No, it's actually about a one-hour show. I would have to close now, but the office says that I can continue, so we could take a real short break, and then we could continue. I want to hear more of what you have to say about Oslo and Norway and, you know.
Okay, let's do that.